Do you eat, sleep, and breathe golf? Do you love to explore? And most importantly, do you just want to have some fun? Well, then welcome to Talking Golf Getaways with Mitch and Darren. Now here's the guy with all the questions, Mitch Lawrence, and the guy with all the answers, Darren Bunch.
Welcome to Talking Golf Getaways. Glad you're with us as always, no matter where you find us, on iTunes or Audio Boom. Or, of course, at golftripx.com. You can find us at Golf Trip Experts on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Darren, you can always find at Golf Getaways on Twitter and Instagram. Me at Mitch Lawrence throughout the online cosmos. Before we talk to our celebrated guest, golf course architect Bobby Weed, just a reminder to check out our incredible Golf Trip X Golf Newsnet listeners trip set for August of 2021 to Ireland and Northern Ireland. I know it seems far away, but trust me, it'll be here before you know it. A collection and really amazing collection of mind-blowing bucket list courses, including Royal County Down, Royal Port Rush, Ardglass, and more, and some amazing lodging spots as well. You don't want to miss it. Go to golfnewsnet.com for details, and I would advise you to hurry up. The spots have already started going fast. All right. Bobby Weed. Often in our great game, the playgrounds we get to enjoy, as you know, are the work of golf course architects with whom we might not be familiar. Our guest today, Bobby Weed of Bobby Weed Golf Design, may be in that category, though with a bit of research and interest, if that's your thing, you'll find his resume and career one of the most influential and interesting in the game. Bobby will be the first to tell you that that resume and career began and have been influenced by one legendary name, Pete Dye. Bobby's first meeting with him in the late 70s at Amelia Island Plantation in Florida, and their collaboration at Long Cove Club on Hilton Head in 1981 led to a career that has now spanned more than four decades and the collaboration and original design of a huge number of golf courses nationwide. In 1983, and this is awesome, Bobby was hired by the PGA Tour. He became the tour's in-house architect in 1987, and from that position, he was responsible for the design or reworking of many of the tour's best-known TPC venues, including the site of this week's tour event, TPC River Highlands in Connecticut, host to the Travelers Championship. In 1994, Bobby formed Bobby Weed Golf Design, set out on his own, and now 20 years and more than 50 projects later, including some of our most played and revered public courses, such as the Slammer and the Squire at the World Golf Village in Florida, Bobby Weed remains a true force for good in the game. You can learn more about him on his website, bobbyweed.com. I highly suggest you do. And right before I bring Bobby in, on a personal note, I just want to relate this to you. I got to hear Bobby at the South Carolina Golf Course Ratings Panel dinner a few months ago. We paid tribute to Pete Dye as the most influential force on golf in South Carolina. It was an unbelievably wonderful sharing by Bobby relative to Mr. Dye and his decades-long relationship with him. Pete, and I'm going to hope that Bobby will let me call him that. I'm sure he'll let me know. Pete, always a bit controversial to anyone who plays the game and has hit shots on a Dye design, but when I listen to Bobby talk about Pete and their relationship and the kind of guy Pete Dye was, as well as stories about his wife, Alice, the talk, the slide presentation was completely eye-opening for me and others that were in the group. In many ways, it is a real pleasure to have a chance to hear some more now. Welcome to Talking Golf Getaways, Bobby. So appreciate you spending some time with us, even though you were in the heavenly spot of Ponte Vedra Beach in Florida. Nice weather, working on a course you're working on. How wonderful life is right now.
It is good. It's nice to be. It's nice when you have a job and you're working in your backyard. It doesn't happen very often. It's been pretty good for the last few months in this crazy world we're living in. But I've been right here. I typically have to get on an airplane to go to work and to be right here at the golf course in my backyard, basically, has been very good.
Cool. What are you working on, if I can ask?
I'm at the Ponte Vedra Inn and Club, redoing. They have 36 holes, and we're renovating the ocean course. And actually, I'm renovating it for the second time. So you know you're getting older when you start redoing your renovations. And we did this in 98, so 22 years later, we're back at it again, and it's a great spot, great club. It's a resort, 5-star resort, and right here on the ocean, and they've got 36 holes, lagoon course, and the ocean course, and we're renovating the ocean course, and project's going very well. We're on schedule and on budget, and all is good. Really excited.
Cool. One good thing is that it's 22 years later, you didn't have to audition for the job, and they re-upped you.
That's right. That's right.
That's good. I had mentioned in our intro, before you joined us here, that I had the opportunity to listen to you at the South Carolina Golf Course Ratings Panel dinner that we had honoring Pete Dye. I described it as eye-opening because for me it was, and I know for everybody in the room it was. The whole presentation that you did and the way you spoke about Pete and Alice and Pete specifically and your relationship to him was off the charts to me. It really was fantastic. And we can't get into all of it here, obviously, or else we'd spend hours, which is fine with me, but listeners may have a problem. But could you just briefly kind of touch on the relationship a bit about, I would love to hear about the first meeting you had with Pete at Amelia Island in Florida and whether or not you had any inkling that meeting would lead to changing the course of your life the way it did.
Well, I met Pete in the 70s and I really don't recall talking about, you know, future opportunities. It was at Amelia Island Plantation in the mid-70s. I was just an intern working in the summer and had been there working for a month or so. And the golf course was just, I'd never seen a golf course quite like that. It's very, very similar to Harbortown, kind of a sister course to Harbortown because it was built by the same development company, Sea Pines Company, Charles Frazier and his company. And they had done Harbortown. Pete had done Harbortown, and in conjunction with Jack Nicklaus, and hosted the Heritage, and starting in the late '60s. And Amelia Island was developed similar to what they did up at Sea Pines Plantation. And so I was there, and they had 27 holes, and they were just fascinating. I mean, every hole was just a piece of art. I'd never seen anything like it. Small greens, pot bunkers, big, long, sandy bunkers, a lot of bulkhead on some lagoons. I had 9 holes on the ocean. I had 9 holes basically through the maritime forest and 9 holes that went out and kissed the marsh. And it was just wonderful. And I was working for a guy named Ron Hill, the superintendent, who was just an encyclopedia of a superintendent. Was so smart. Became one of my mentors. And so from an agronomic and maintenance standpoint, I was a sponge and soaking everything up I could. All of the golf courses were pure sand. I grew up in South Carolina, and we had a lot of clay and rock, and it wasn't very easy to dig a hole. And when I came down to North Florida at Amelia Island Plantation, I was the first one to volunteer to dig a hole because it was all pure sand, and I could almost bury myself. So any kind of irrigation breaks or issues, it was no problem for me because it was almost therapeutic digging a hole in sand. But that's where I first met Pete. And I don't recall much about first meeting him other than the fact that he was the architect, and I had a chance to tag along a little bit with him. And immediately, he's such a likable guy, and immediately took to him, and just stayed in touch. And then, I don't know, sometime maybe the next year, he was going to be going back to Hilton Head doing another golf course, another private club, and knew that my background was agronomy and horticulture, and My dad was in construction. My grandparents were farmers, so I'd been around equipment, and he knew that I was from South Carolina. I started in Aiken, South Carolina, and then kind of grew up middle of the state outside of Columbia. And he and Alice thought that I may be a good fit up in Hilton Head, so they kind of adopted me, and I took off and went to Hilton Head with them probably around 1980, right there when they were working at Sawgrass, the Tournament Players Club at Sawgrass. So I was able to bounce back and forth and see some of that construction, but I was up at Hilton Head for the most part.
And this was at Long Cove?
Yes, it was. We were building Long Cove. We were actually doing some work at Harbortown early on, but we had a condo on the ocean, and Pete pretty much set up shop there, and he was bouncing back and forth between Ponte Vedra and Hilton Head. So that was my first start, and getting a chance to work side by side with Pete from the very beginning, you know, just pretty much initiated a 45-year relationship after that.
And I know at the dinner you kept talking about, you know, I said one of the great things about golf to all of us who play it, we are touched by so many people. We may just go out for a round of golf, but the people who are involved in giving us that ground to play on and the art, as you call it, we're touched by so many people along the way. And for people who've played and play Pete Dye golf courses, there's such a wide variety of how people feel about those particular courses. They usually elicit some kind of response on all different levels, which is really interesting to me. It's such an individual game. We all look at it from our own perspective. But when I heard you talk that night in Myrtle Beach, what really struck me was when you talked about the relationship that you had with Pete, about what an incredibly, I could never put it into the words you did, but what an incredibly down-to-earth guy he was, the way he looked at the world and his work. And I think some people, I know I didn't get the depth of what you were talking about till I heard it from you, who had this long relationship with him.
Well, that's right. He kind of had an aw shucks attitude. He had a great Midwest wit. He grew up in Urbana, Ohio, and then ultimately met and married Alice, who was from Indianapolis, and they settled in Indianapolis. So he came from the Midwest, and you know, he, what really struck me about Pete was he was never seeking the limelight. All he wanted to do was build great golf courses. And, you know, the money didn't really matter, it seemed like, because he really didn't own a car. He had a contract with National Rental Car, and I think he thought of National Rental Car as like a Ford or a Chevrolet. A National car was just like a Ford or a Chevrolet. And he didn't, he wasn't trying to impress anybody. He basically wore khakis, and he'd buy those khaki breeches down in the free trade zone in the Dominican Republic. And, he'd get them by the gross. And as far as golf shirts, you know, whoever he was working for would typically supply him with golf shirts and sweaters and rain jackets and whatnot. So, you know, he was always, he had two pair of Brogans. He had one clean, really clean pair. And then he had a pair that he'd wear on the job site every day, but it didn't matter. He'd still get those cleaned once or twice a week as well. And, just very, very simple, and lived his life very simple. And he and Alice were, you know, as long as they were playing golf and building golf courses, then all was good.
Well, it obviously says a lot about you that you were part of that life that they lived. I think one thing you said, which really struck me that night, was because I think a lot of people, and me included early on, had this idea of Pete as a really stern guy because he built golf courses, some of them that were stern. And you said, and correct me if I'm wrong, I'm paraphrasing probably, but you said, if you like golf, if you love golf and you play golf, then Pete was your friend. That's kind of the way he approached people.
Yeah, no question. No question. He had a very, very strong work ethic. And, I mean, he was like the ever ready guy. I mean, he would just go and go and go. And, that struck me as a great attribute. My dad had a great work ethic and was fortunate enough to hand that down to me. But Pete was very similar to that. And he was a great amateur golfer. And of course, Alice mm-hmm. was a very noted amateur golfer. And their two sons, Perry and Phoebe, both grew up playing golf and playing in the dirt with Pete and Alice, and have become, you know, lifelong friends as well. So it was a family affair for them. And I only know one other person that was as passionate about the game and about golf than Pete, who ultimately became my greatest mentor. And I was very blessed to work for the PGA Tour for about 13 years, and I was able to be really good friends and very close with Dean Beeman. And I mean, Dean, as a commissioner of the PGA Tour, I mean, he truly lived, breathed golf like nobody I've ever seen. And you know, between Dean from a business standpoint and from a golf standpoint, and then Pete from a design and construction perspective, and then Ron Hill from an agronomic standpoint, I'm like, they were three legends and three of the best in their field of all time. And of course, you know, Pete was arguably, without any question to me, the greatest modern day golf course architect there's been. And what Dean Beeman did to grow the game on a worldwide basis, and what he did to grow the PGA Tour, he should be getting boxes of chocolate and roses every month from all these tour players because of what he did.
Makes complete sense. Interesting, too, how it kind of fades into the background, but when you're involved with it, as you were, and in certain ways still are, and you really get it, that kind of, it's an unfortunate thing, I think. But hopefully we can keep bringing that up and people will keep checking it out and give Dean, well, obviously Pete, but Dean too, some of the accolades that he deserves. Do you want to touch just briefly on your time at the TPC? I think you were hired by the tour as a superintendent. Is that right?
Yes, we were in the condo one night after Jerry Pate had won the inaugural event at the Players Championship in 82. And Pete and I were finishing up at Long Cove, and I was in the condo one night. The phone rang, and Pete was talking to Dean Beeman. And of course, I could only hear one side of that conversation, but it kind of went like, "Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I'm not sure why we did that, but yes, sir, we can fix that." And it just went on and on and on. And at the end of the conversation, he's like, "Yes, sir. I've got a young man here. We're finished up here, and I'll send him on down, and we'll start making some modifications. His name is Bobby Weed, and he'll be down there next month." And he got off the phone, and he said, "You need to go to Ponte Vedra, and we've got to make some changes to the golf course." And I came down as the superintendent, and also to make all the changes with Pete and oversee all those changes. And Dean was in a bit of a pickle because the players were just in an uproar over that golf course. They had never seen anything like that, and mm-hmm. I'm convinced the golf course was ahead of its time, and it ushered in a whole new era of golf course design, and it became a little bit of a challenge between Jack and Pete, escalating into who could build the hardest golf course. And it really tipped the pendulum to one side where everybody else kind of followed suit. And you know, photography really came into effect, and harder, more difficult, more challenging, more contrast, bigger, faster, better is, you know, was the norm. And then the next thing you know, Jack had built a couple of courses out at Desert Highlands, and then later on, Pete did PGA West, and it was a bit of an arms race, so to speak, from a design standpoint. And yeah, we probably, in retrospect and looking back, we probably all stepped on the gas a little bit too much. But that's what the clients, were calling for. You know, Pete's first question always to a potential client was talking about what kind of golf course they wanted. You know, his question was always, well, who's going to be playing the golf course? And when, you know, he built 22, 24 golf courses for, I think it was Landmark. And they all, you know, they were wanting to build tournament golf courses, high profile golf courses, to test the great players. And, so, you know, everybody just kept stepping on the gas. And, you know, when you start building golf courses for less than 1% of people that play the game, it probably can catch up to you. And, maybe it did over time. And, what's been interesting is over the last 10 years or so, we've kind of gone back the other way a little bit. So I think we're in a good place right now. We're just not building many golf courses because of the attrition to the game and less people playing the game. But, you know, we have a lot of great allied associations working together today to try to build alternative golf courses, to understand, we all understand who's playing the golf courses today. And while the range of golfers is probably never been greater. I mean, obviously you can't start out any less than the basement as a beginner, but the ceiling has just continued to get higher and higher because the best players just keep getting better and better, longer and longer. So today, I think the real challenge today is building playable golf courses. It's difficult to build tournament golf courses. But it's a challenge, and that's a challenge that I think as golf course designers, we readily accept today. And I think therein lies a great challenge to build golf courses and accommodate the more varying type of golfers that we have.
What an amazing perspective that you have. I'm serious. I really haven't ever heard anybody talk about that time in building where, from the perspective you have being associated with it and kind of where we are now. That's a discussion that could go on for a long time. I could just talk to you about having, as an architect, because you've done this throughout your career, when we're going to talk about a couple of courses, and it seems to me, just hearing what you're saying, that line has to be walked carefully. A couple that were, especially one that we're going to talk about, the line won't be so firm because the client that we're going to be talking about had a very specific idea in mind of what he was looking to do. That, of course, Michael Jordan and Grove 23. But right. Relative to other places, you've gotten to experience a single client like that in a way, a client which is the PGA Tour and TPC courses and tour events, private memberships, public play. I mean, you really have experienced the whole nature of who we building golf courses for. I think it's got to be not only interesting, but a continual challenge for you in terms of how you approach every project that you're building.
Well, every project is unique. The site is unique and different, and the challenges are always going to be varying from site to site, whether I'm working out west or in Texas, where it's more arid, and or in the mountains of North Carolina, or on the coast up and down the eastern seaboard, or down in Florida. So, yeah, I mean, it's not only are the sites all unique and different, present challenges, but the clients do as well. And, you know, whether you're building public golf, private golf, municipal golf, resort golf, all of that comes into play for sure. But I too have taken up with what Pete early would say early on is, you know, who's going to play the golf course? Who are we building this golf course for? I think that's a good starting point.
Well, let's get into some of the courses. I'm going to talk about a couple. Eventually, want to definitely talk about the public courses, because here on Talking Golf Getaways, we are about golfers and traveling and playing public courses. Most private courses are not easy to get on, if you can get on them at all. But there's a couple that I really want to talk to you about, because they've been so much. One of them so much in the golfer's mind, and that was, of course, a couple of weeks ago with the Match 2 and the medalist, and a fascinating to me history, kind of a through line. And we can't go too deeply into it because we don't have that much time, but, you know, the through line from Pete Dye to Greg Norman to you again. But we all got to see it. It was very rare that we got to see the medalist. You talk about the people that are playing the golf course. This one has a pretty exclusive membership: Tiger, Rory, Justin Thomas, Brooks Koepka, Dustin Johnson, Ricky Fowler, Patrick Cantlay, Matt Wolf. There were Tiger tees added to it, so I assume you got to do some work with Tiger. Talk a little bit about what we all saw when we got to see the medalist. I was so happy to get a real look at what that golf course is now.
It's a great golf course, first and foremost. It was a fantastic routing. It was a challenge from day one. Low piece of ground, had a lot of freshwater marshes that meandered through it, had a lot of wetlands, and Pete fashioned that golf course, and couldn't have happened without creating a closed drainage system to where all the water was captured and recirculated and put back into an irrigation lagoon and pumped back out on a continuing basis. So the engineering and what was underground in that was right in Pete's wheelhouse, because he was always a bit of an engineer when it came to drainage. And early on, I learned that if a golf course didn't drain, nothing else matters. And as you turned on the television to watch that event, You saw all the rainfall, and I was like, oh my gosh, I hope the drainage system is working. I hope all the pumps are working, because we basically have about 6 or 8 lift stations out there, and all the water drains that falls, it goes into these drain basins, and then it all gets centralized to these lift stations and then gets lifted and pumped back to a big holding pond or the irrigation pond. But it all worked really, really well. And the course, you know, dried out, and they were able to host the event. Whereas on most any other golf course, they would not have stuck a peg in the ground or played a hole. So right. that in itself was a marvel to watch, not to mention the excellent conditions that the superintendent there, a young man named Jason Jobson, is a superintendent, has a fantastic staff and crew. And, you know, they keep that golf course near tournament condition at all times. There's only a handful of golf courses that if the PGA Tour showed up and says, hey, could we play a tour event here next week? You could do that at the medalist, because they have a very discriminating membership, and they have a great mix, and they have a whole posse of tour players that live down in that Jupiter area and that are members out there, and they play and they practice out there, and it's a big golf course. I'm convinced the tour players love being there because they can truly hit drivers. There's mm-hmm. too many golf courses they play today where they're throttled back, but I tell you, at the medalist, and they don't even play when they're home. They don't even play some of those Tiger tees. It's just, right. You know, as a tour player, you know, when you're practicing and when you're playing, you don't want to go out there and get beat up. It's like going to the ocean course at Kiowa. You know, I'm up there and I'm like asking the caddies, I'm like, so how many tour players come through here? And they're like, hardly any. Nobody wants to go there until they have to play, because so the back tees are so brutal. I mean, the place just beats you up, and tour players are out there working on their game, and they're working on two things. They're working on confidence and repetition. And and so they don't want to get beat up. But they really like playing that golf course because it's all right there in front of you. And it is so magnificently conditioned. It's firm. It's fast. It's the nearest thing to tournament conditions. They play on a week-to-week basis. Then that's their home golf course. So those guys actually have a bit of an edge living down there, in my opinion, because they're playing that course and a couple of others where they get near tournament-like conditions all the time.
Makes sense. Can I ask you a quick question? Because I saw something in reading about it that I had never heard this term used. And I'm pretty sure you said it, but you came in 2015. We won't go into the history of what happened before that. But when you came in, you did what was called a retrovation of the golf course. And I've heard of renovation and restoration, as most people have. But I thought it was fascinating that you were trying to keep it up to what you're talking about now and yet bring part of it back to what Pete Dye had envisioned and built when he originally built the medal.
I think it was more along the lines of a sympathetic restoration. I had the benefit of seeing the and Alice and Pete had given me a tape of a shell match that was taped in '95 between Greg Norman and Nick Price, who back in that day they were back and forth as the number one golfers in the world, and so they had when the club opened, they hosted a shell match. And so I had that, Alice gave me that tape. And so I was able to play that tape back and forward. And they had a lot of aerial shots. So I could actually see the drain basins where they were. And so I was basically putting the golf course back to where it was when it first opened, but cleaning up the edges and adding some length but really in a sympathetic way back to the way it was when the golf course opened. It had all sod wall bunkers, and they all disappeared. And when we went back in there in 2015, we put all of that back in and just wrapped the golf course in screenings, native screenings and sand around the property, and opened up all the long views and vistas across those freshwater marshes. And, there's just so much bird life out there, so much wildlife out there. And there's only houses on one hole, along one hole set back. And so everything about the project was done to a very, very high standard. And both, Pete was the architect, but I know Greg wanted to get into design, and Pete was in favor of that, and was always very open and sharing of his knowledge, and Greg took advantage of that. And after working with Pete, ended up going and opening a design firm of his own because that's something he wanted to do. So it was a great place for Greg to cut his teeth, and he had a lot of involvement as a founding member. And but the golf course changed quite a bit over a period of 15 plus or minus years. And so we were able to go back in and just take a good view of everything. That's a good thing about renovating a golf course. You keep what's good and you fix what's bad, and you recognize and you see all that. And we were able to put the greens back down on the ground the way Pete had envisioned them. And we were able to put back in all the sod wall bunkers and then along the way to keep up with the game today versus 1995, we were able to put in some new tees and got Tiger's permission to lend a hand at that. And that was fun. But, we had Stacy Lewis out there playing. We had a number of girls out there, tour players. And then we had all the PGA tour players and some of the other tours, their players were residing there. And then of course, some great businessmen that are members down there, and just a, membership. The membership is what makes the club so great. The golf course obviously is the roots and the foundation, but you know, at the end of the day, it's the membership that makes a club as great as it is. And the Medalist is blessed with a wonderful membership. And so it's a good mix. You know, the tour players can come in there and they're not treated any differently than anybody else, basically. And, you know, they have plenty of room to roam and nobody's really bothering them too much. And they're just kind of like one of the guys and they play with the members. It's a really good situation.
Well, it sounds fantastic. I watched that Shell's Wonderful World of Golf match before I watched the match, too. And I love, Jack Whitaker said of the Medalist, this was 1995, he said, this is going to be a golf course that you'll hear about for years to come. Now, I don't think he had an idea that 25 years later we'd be, you know, still there, but I assume he understood the greatness of it, so... What a wonderful place. Let's move, if we can, to a course that's going to make some history this week. That's TPC River Highlands. And another great history. I'm going to just really quickly, for our listeners, because I'm pretty sure most of them won't know it, but the club itself was founded in 1928 as Middletown Golf Club. Became Edgewood Country Club in 1934. I didn't realize the history that was actually at this place. In the early 80s, bought by the PGA Tour, the golf course was redesigned to TPC standards by Pete Dye, reopened as the TPC of Connecticut in 1984, and underwent further remodeling in 1989 by you, Bobby Weed, in consultation with Tour pros Howard Twitty and Roger Maltby. It was renamed the TPC at River Highlands. People have been watching now for a number of years. We've gotten used to seeing it. It's always a great event to watch for so many reasons. Tell us a little bit about when you came in, some of the work you did, and maybe you've worked with, and we'll touch on it, so many great collaborators along the way, but Howard Twitty and Roger Maltby.
Well, I remember Pete going up there in the early, mid-80s. The Pearson family owned that golf course. It was a public access golf course, if I recall. And Pete went up there and visited with the Pearson family along with the PGA Tour because it's such a golf-starved area up there. They just love their golf. And there's so many great golf courses in that Connecticut area. And Pete came back and said, I just visited the most unbelievable place. He said, I was up there and it rained the whole time. And he said, it was dry as a bone, had great contour, and parts of it was an old sand quarry, sand and gravel quarry. And so they didn't have much money. Nobody had much money. The tour cut a deal with the Pearson family. Bought them out and converted as best they could. And Pete basically kind of redid the back nine, and it was much different than the front nine. They were just two completely separate nines. And they played some events there, and they renovated the old clubhouse. And then when I was with the PGA Tour, I went in up there. My partner with the PGA Tour, Britt Stinson, and I went up there and basically did a repurposing concept where we were able to purchase some additional land down along the river, but we created a development element. And with that new land, we were able to route some holes down on the river. And in doing so, we were able to renovate the entire golf course, 1 through 18, to really tie it back in and make it a contiguous 18-hole golf course that had the same feel throughout. So we redid Pete's nine and we redid the original nine and tied it all into a new golf course. And I think they played their first event there in 91. And about that time, we were taking a survey of the tour players about, you know, what was their ideal golf course for scoring, you know, under par and whatnot. And they said they would get the best players on the tour more consistently if the scores were somewhere in this 8 under to 12 under range, it seemed to be the wheelhouse where it would attract a better field. And we built a good golf course, and some guys got on board. Corey Pavin started talking about the golf course, and the next thing you know, David Duval was up there playing, and some of the other top names at the time. And it started attracting a much better field, and the tournament really grew and was very much accepted. It's part of the Tournament Players Club network, and we had some good spectator areas, and the golf course had wonderful topo. And we were able to, you know, I took a tour of all these great Connecticut golf courses before I started up there, and I kept going to these great old clubs up there, and I kept finding some really quirky golf holes, and quirky had seemed to be kind of out of favor, and quirky is really good. Quirky can be really good, and so we've got that golf course has a bit of quirkiness up there, in a couple of short par fours and some semi-blind holes up over ridges where you can't see everything. But like Pete always told me, he's like, heck, it's only blind once. And, after that, you're on your own. And, so I fell in with that. And, we've got a little quirkiness up there, and, it's a par 70. It's probably the shortest course on the PGA Tour. But even today, the players are so well taken care of. The folks up there just really come out. It's one of the more heavily attended events anywhere in the country. Folks love their golf up there, and, the tour players are treated so well. Well, they're treated well every week, wherever they go. But they just, they have a love and affinity for this golf course. And, it really doesn't favor anybody in particular. You really need to work your ball, around the golf course as far as, hitting it left to right and right to left. And, they like the quirkiness of the golf course, I believe. And, they've got a great sponsor and the Travelers. So, it's been a real success, and it shows that it's one of the events that they have chosen to play in this really shortened season, starting. And we're going to have some phenomenal golf here over the next 5 or 6 months. It's just going to be action packed with some majors stacked in on top of each other. There's just going to be so much great golf, to finish up the year. And it's really great that they're at Harbortown this mm-hmm. weekend, and they're going to be at Travelers up at River Highlands playing our course up there next week. So it just speaks to, trying to touch all these great areas of the country with some of these great venues, and squeeze in some fantastic golf here that everybody's really starving for right now.
Yeah, I totally agree. And great words on the tournament at the Travelers, because I think everybody agrees the community involvement and the excitement and enthusiasm of the people is one of the things that draws everybody to watch it. I'm going to admit something. I was going to try to talk to you a little bit about Michael's course, Grove 23, but I'm going to keep going because I do want to talk about a few of the public tracks that you've had a hand in that people really love and get to play. So I'm going to put Michael Jordan, not many people can do this, Bobby. I'm going to put Michael Jordan on the back burner. And I'm hoping that at some time when you have some more time, we can really dig into it, because I think it's a great topic that people would be interested. But I'd like to just get back to golf and travel. We haven't been able to do it a lot, given the situation, but there's places around the country, we'll mention a few of them, where you've had hand, heart, mind involved in the building of golf courses, which people love. Talk briefly, if you would, about one of my favorite spots for a number of reasons. But the Slammer and the Squire at World Golf Village. I've played the golf course a number of times. I've been down to the World Golf Village a number of times. It had to be a pretty amazing experience, I would assume, for you, given the chance to work at the World Golf Village, to have that kind of lofty position. There is another golf course there, which, we can all go play too, but I'm going to concentrate on the Slammer and the Squire and the chance to work with Sam Snead and Gene Sarazen. Can you tell us a little bit about what that experience was like?
Well, it was fantastic. I was back when I was still with the PGA Tour, and they moved mm-hmm. they moved the Hall of Fame down to the World Golf Village, which is located down near St. Augustine here in North Florida, below Jacksonville. And it was a great opportunity. 36 holes there, Slammer and the Squire and the King and the Bear, and the Slammer and Squire having a chance to work with Sam Snead and Gene Sarazen was certainly a highlight for me. I mean, you're talking about two national treasures without question. And I had the chance and opportunity to go visit them. I actually stayed with Sam Snead at his house up in Virginia. And it was just wonderful. I have some handwritten letters from Gene Sarazen he addressed the letters and he handwrote these letters to me. And I'm in the process of getting them framed right now. And it was just wonderful because they came from a different era. And to get their perspective on the game, they were such great storytellers. Gene Sarazen was just a consummate gentleman, you know, dressed to the T's all the time. And Sam, I used to always joke, I always thought Sam Snead was the oldest teenager I ever knew. And he was just a classic, and his swing. I mean, everything about him. I mean, not many people know that Sam Snead made a hole in one with every club in his bag except a putter. And Gene Sarazen had the longest running. Gene Sarazen had the longest running sports contract of any athlete of any time of any era, over 75 years with the Wilson Sporting Goods Company. And part of his job early on when he signed with Wilson was to go find new talent. And he's the one actually who brought Sam Snead to Wilson as well. So a lot of great history there. But just being around those guys and also had the chance to do the same thing with Byron Nelson out in Texas. And and obviously working with Arnold Palmer and Jack Nicklaus, you know, just all these guys are just national treasures in every way, including Raymond Floyd, just some of the great players that span so many eras of our great history of golf in this country. And for Sam to lend his name and Gene as well, and to spend time with them, you know, it was interesting. You know, I had them on site one day during construction, and I was showing them around, and you know, Gene made a comment. He's like, "Gosh, Bobby, this is all dirt. I can't really comment too much because it's just all dirt." And I found that very interesting. He's like, "When you get it finished, I'll be able to tell you a little bit more." And which was kind of funny because we were down there, you know, trying to make design decisions and design changes. So I would end up spending more time, not in the field, but on, you know, looking at a plan and drawing golf holes and talking about strategy and whatnot. So I found that to be quite interesting with both of them, but such colorful individuals that were great storytellers. I mean, I was just like a little kid just tagging along almost with those guys because I was just hanging on everything they had to say. I mean, these guys are going back telling me stories from the 30s, telling me about, you know, the very first Masters event at Augusta, talking about how they tag teamed and played events all across the country. And, you know, those guys didn't play for any money. Those guys weren't allowed in the clubhouse early on. Gene Sarazen kind of ushered in, you know, pros being able to go into clubhouses. Golf pros, I mean, people can't even understand that today. These pros made such little money. They'd make more money in Calcutta's associated with, you know, nearby events where they were playing a tour event. They could make as much money or more money playing these Calcutta events than they would be playing these tour events. They just weren't playing for much money. And those were tough times. You know, people talk about those were the good old days. Well, let me tell you this. Gene Sarazen said those were far from the good old days. No AC, and we weren't allowed in the clubhouses, and we weren't paid much money at all. He said those were difficult. Those were difficult and tough times. But you know what? They laid the foundation for what the PGA Tour is today. And everybody that's on any of the tours today should certainly be respectful, and they really all are of their elders and folks that started the tour back then.
Well, what a great, obviously great stuff about all of it and the chance to work with the two of them. You've had a chance, and I think I have to say, every time I've been down at the World Golf Village, the history is obviously what a lot of people go for. But to just be able to soak all this in, and next time I go to the Slammer and the Squire, I'm going to be soaking in those stories and those thoughts as I go around. We don't have a whole lot of time left. I wanted to touch on a few of the other public golf courses that you were involved in. I might just let you kind of describe them the way you want, touch on them as you want, but the places that traveling golfers can go and get a hit on your work and the love you have for the game and your obvious talent. But TPC Las Vegas, you worked with Ray Floyd, you just mentioned him on there, a lot of tour events there. But these are the kind of places that we love to travel and play because the tour pros play them, but we also get a chance to. TPC Las Vegas, TPC Tampa Bay. From what I can gather, I haven't had a chance to play that, but a real partnership between the environment there in Tampa Bay, wildlife, and just an absolutely a great spot. Those two TPC courses, I'll let you just touch on those. There's a couple others I just want to briefly mention before we leave.
Well, they're great venues. They've hosted tour events, and more often than not, they're very well-conditioned golf courses, conditioned to a higher level than you may be accustomed to. And there's no better combination when you can mix good design and good maintenance together. I mean, we've all played golf courses that have been well maintained, but maybe not to a high level of design, or vice versa. And these venues you're mentioning, they were well constructed golf courses, and I'd like to think they had some good design integrity. And but they're being maintained to a high level, and they're being operated to a high degree. So those are all great combinations that the general public can go access and play. And I think that's very important because they get to play on golf courses that have hosted tour events, whether it be a regular tour event or a senior tour event or champions event, they call them today. And then you go up to Minnesota, you go to Minneapolis, and you can play Stone Ridge, which is traditionally ranked one of the top public access golf courses in that Minneapolis area. And there's nobody that gets outdoors more in the summer than the folks that live up there, because they just, you know, they have some harsh winters, and boy, when it comes time to get outside and outdoors, they really enjoy their golf up there. In Stone Ridge is just a fantastic public access golf course, and it's all sand, part of an old sand quarry up there, and we fashion a great routing and very, very well conditioned golf course. That's a great spot to for the folks that are in and around Minneapolis to go play at Stone Ridge, obviously we've got a number of others around the country. We've got some good public golf up in Philadelphia, which Philadelphia may be one of the great spots in the country for golf. The soil is so perfectly suited, very fertile, great topo, great vegetation, great trees up there. And Glenn Mills is a golf course that the general public can play in the Philadelphia area. And there's so much great golf in and around that area of the country. So we're just blessed. We're blessed with so many great areas of the country and good golf courses everywhere. So I think your viewers and listeners and golfers can they all have access, and you know, with the internet today, they can seek out all these golf courses. We have a 1925 golf course that we operated and managed and kind of pulled back from the brink of extinction down in Palatka, Florida, North Florida, right along the St. John's River in North Florida. Is a 1925 Donald Ross golf course, and I'm telling you, it's a 6,000 yard golf course, par 70. You can play it in 3 hours, and we have a couple of amateur events here every year. We have a senior azalea, we have the regular azalea, And those fields are full every single year. And these kids come in there because they give a lot of Ryder Cup points. And these young college kids come in there and they're just licking their chops. And these greens are about as big as a table you're sitting in front of.
And so they're thinking because it's 6,000 yards, they're going, really?
Really? Oh, yeah. And the golf course really stands up very, very well. And frankly, we need more of those kind of golf courses. That's a great golf course. It's hard to lose a golf ball. And you can play it in 3 hours. And, you know, you think 6,000 yards. Well, just go ask some of these great amateurs that come through there. I mean, they've got a who's who list of Azalea champions that have played there for decades. It's either the first or second longest running amateur event in the state of Florida, and they just flock there in March to play the Azalea and the senior Azalea, and it's just a public access golf course, and I think we need more of those kind of golf courses as well.
Well, what's one thing that gives us all hope is to hear you say that, because you are an influencer. There's no other way to put it. But the other thing is that Darren, my partner, and I have been having so many conversations with various people, as I know you have, about moving toward that kind of experience on the public access level. Shorter, faster, fun, good, challenging, all those things together. So I'm hoping that we're all getting the idea. We've been hit over the head for a while. I think it's time we kind of opened up. Before I let you go, I wanted to mention one of my favorite places. I live in Myrtle Beach. I get to travel up and down the East Coast. Have spent a real bit of time over the last 20, 25 years down in Hilton Head. Hilton Head National is a place that when I first went down there, I got to experience. It opened in 1991. Interesting concept to me. I was just interested because it's the first chance I've ever had to talk to you about it. But you designed, if I'm not mistaken, you designed 9 holes and Gary Player did 9 holes. Is that right?
Well, I think there may have been 27 holes there or 18 holes there by Gary Player, and we added another 9 and ended up closing a 9. So we merged. You're partly correct in that we now basically have 9 remaining holes from the Gary Player layout and 9 holes that we did, and they've been merged together. And great public golf, great service. Scratch Golf is the operator, and we've done a number of projects for them over a number of decades, and they do a great job. They present great conditions on a consistent basis. They have a great staff, great food and beverage, and they're very accommodating. And coming to Hilton Head and with the with the great year-round conditions there that you can play 12 months is a great opportunity for folks that are coming up and down the Eastern Seaboard to stop in and play some great golf in Hilton Head.
Well, it's been a number of years since I played it, but I just remember I love the location. When I just getting ready to talk to you today, I love Gary Player said that it's 300 acres of the best tree-rich bottom land he'd ever seen. Which
it's got a great array for pine trees, live oak trees, mm-hmm. A lot of wildlife out there, and a lot of lagoons, freshwater lagoons that run through the property. So, it's a nice experience. And, you know, golf has been pretty good here during these last few months. You know, people still been able to get out and play a lot of golf courses, and in some difficult times, it's been really good for the golf courses that are open to be able to have play and people walk and utilize their social distancing and play golf. You know, the problem with public golf and with really any golf today, no matter what level you're on. A couple things that we have less of today than ever before. You know, we just have less disposable time than ever before. So, we're creating some golf now. We're gonna build another golf course where you can play loops of 3 holes at a time. And being a little more ingenious with some of the routings that are out there today allows players a little more flexibility in playing, because I think we all recognize that we, as we raise our families, that, you know, a lot of us have less disposable time, and we got to spread it out a little bit more, and we have less disposable income for some of these activities. So, you know, affordable golf, I think, is back in vogue now, and we're seeing that, and the consumer, you know, is getting to experience that, and it's a little bit easier on their pocketbook, and we need to make golf more affordable for the masses, and continue to get new people into the game, and be cognizant of the fact that, you know, hey, we need to be able to get around a little bit quicker. That's been a bit of an anchor that we've been dragging around, but I think we're waking up to that. And so, you know, having accessible golf and creating a little more, having a little better value out there, is a good thing. And understanding that we all do have less disposable time and frankly, less disposable money, because we've got to spread it around, you know, to other aspects of the family. And, so I think golf is positioned for, you know, to continue to bring new folks into the game. And we've got so many great allied associations that are working with a common goal in mind of doing just that. So I'm very energized over where we are and where hopefully we're going.
Wow, what a fantastic end to a wonderful conversation. There's so many of us that are grateful to you, not just for what you've given us in the past, but what you're doing now and what you just talked about, because with voices like that, we'll be fine. I have no doubt that we'll be fine. There's a lot more. You're doing projects. Like I said, I'd love to talk to you about Michael's course at some point down the road. We'll be watching River Highlands this week. And I can't thank you enough for taking time out of your schedule to just sit and talk about all this stuff. It's been fascinating, really interesting, and uplifting in a lot of ways. So I wish you the best. I wish Leslie the best, your family, Pontevedra, the club you're working on, all of it. It's been great having you with us, Bobby. I hope we can do it again soon.
Well, thanks so much, and glad to be with you guys today. And hopefully we can get out on the golf course together sometime.
Wouldn't that be nice? Wouldn't that be nice? I have a bunch of hickories that I'd love you to hit.
I have trouble hitting the ones I have.
Yeah, but that's, you've got to give up on that and just go, oh, these look like fun. Trust me.
There you go. Great.
All right. Thanks again. Hope I see you soon.
Take care.
Okay. To all our listeners, thanks. We couldn't do it without you. Keep in contact with us at Golf Trip Experts on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And if you have the chance, rate us on iTunes so we can continue to spotlight the best in golf travel. Thanks again to Bobby Weed for spending some wonderful time. You can find out more about Bobby and keep up with what he's doing at bobbyweed.com. He has been dreaming about golf and golf courses for a long, long time and making those dreams come true for himself and for us. Hope you keep running down your own dream. So long.